Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome. Good to have you all with us here on The Mark Steiner Show. And, of course, Soundbites here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And Marva Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM for our weekly look at food, farming, and the environment. And we are going to start our show off today with a conversation that was inspired by yet another piece written by Gerald Weingrad, former Maryland State Senator, attorney, adjunct professor at the University of Maryland School of Public Policy, where he's taught graduate course on Chesapeake Bay restoration since 1988. Joining us as well is Brenda Davis, natural resources biologist at the Maryland Department of Natural Resources, and Tom Parham, who is an environmental specialist with the Maryland Department of Natural Resources. And folks, welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Jerry, good morning. Did we lose Jerry? All right, we'll get right to, I was going to let him open up, but let's go right back to him. So one of the issues here is that the bay we have is clearly in bad shape, and some people are calling for an end to the harvest of crabs and rockfish and more. And though other people are saying, as Jerry will say when he gets back on the line here, is that we have to go well beyond this 10% drop in female harvest for crabs, that the question of runoff is destroying many piles of manure, produce 58% of the phosphorus and 44% of the nitrogen from flowing in. Jerry, are you there?
I am.
So let me please lay out your argument real fast about what you think needs to happen right now so our guests can respond.
Well, on the blue crabs, the controllable element here is on harvest. Whatever reason folks want to attribute to this very sharp and very substantial decline in our total crab population, and particularly of spawning females, which is below the threshold level for serious actions, we need to cut back on harvest now, not studying it, not talking to watermen again and again and again and postponing this until September, October. Right now, even now in May, with the decline, commercial watermen, unbelievably, in this day and age, can take and keep literally many bushels of blue crabs. In fact, in Maryland, if you have the right license and you have two helpers, right now this month you can be keeping 11 bushels of females a day. In April it was 18, and this goes all the way up to 30 in October. That's ridiculous. A recreational crabber can't keep one female crab, not a bushel. They can't keep one. I crab off my pier. I wouldn't keep females. I can't keep one, not even a soft crab female. But a commercial waterman can take up to 30 during the period of year. That's number one. And two, we also need to crack down on the number of male crabs taken, because there are some theories that, particularly in creeks and small tributaries of the bay where crabs actually mate, there's not enough males and not enough big males with the actual amount of sperm to completely and totally fertilize the females like they should be. So that's the first priority, that you can't duck and say it's the red drum eating the crabs. It was the cold winter, especially when the crab harvest takes maybe around 40% of the total available crabs.
So, Brenda, how do you respond to that?
Well, the management strategy that is currently in place is a very sound strategy, and it's not just developed by the department, but the Chesapeake Bay Stock Assessment Committee. And the harvest target for mature females bay-wide is 25.5% of the population. For six consecutive years, we have been at or below that level of harvest bay-wide. So we have successfully been managing harvest. And there is not a lot of indication that further reducing harvest would offset the negative impact of doing that.
So, but the reality is, and let me just jump in. I know that Tom, you have a you're not into the crab world. It's not necessarily yours, but you can jump in as well. But I mean, it seems to me that we're talking about crabs, or whether we're talking about rockfish, or whether we're talking about other things that we like to other beings we like to kind of harvest from the bay, that we're in trouble here, and that some people have argued In papers and other places that we should just cancel all harvest now, let the place replenish. We're looking at people who want to the battle over oyster beds was in the papers just a couple of weeks ago. You know, are we going to have development on the shore to build new golf courses and townhouses, or are we going to try to replenish the bay with oysters? I mean, it seems to me that something fundamental has to happen here if we are serious about restoring the bay. And addressing everything from the PMT and runoff on farms to the overdevelopment and runoff from people's homes and businesses. I mean, this is a huge issue, Jerry.
Well, I agree, and I'm very disappointed to hear from DNR that they don't believe that harvest restrictions will help the crab recover. If it weren't for those harvest restrictions by Maryland and Virginia back in 2007 and 8, when the Maryland governor, Governor O'Malley, petitioned Governor George Bush, President Bush, and the Department of Commerce to declare the blue crab a disaster. And they actually did and gave $15 million to the state to help the watermen recover from this disaster that was human caused by the lack of controls on pollution, particularly from agriculture, which the O'Malley administration has failed to do, aggressively address, and also because of the lack of proper controls in the harvest. So when Maryland and Virginia put their heads together and started the restrictions, we saw a rebound. And the rebound was hearty, but we failed to continue restrictions as the numbers declined radically last year. And to say that restricting the harvest won't help, then what will? If we can't restrict the harvest and we won't have the political will to do that, then we're not going to see a recovery of the blue crab because our pollution control efforts are not achieving the goals of restoring bay grasses and restoring oyster populations to tenfold the biomass of what they were in 1994. So if you don't control the harvest, what will you control? You can't control the weather. You can't control climate and the factors to do with the actual spawning, whether you have the tides and the salinity. And unless you start cracking down on the polluters much more than we have the political will on agriculture particularly and stormwater runoff, your only element, and it's unfortunate for the watermen because they're the ones that suffer from this lack of political will to control the pollution, is to control the harvest. And so if those harvest restrictions are working so well, my question to the young lady from DNR, then why haven't the crabs recovered? Why are they declining like this if they've worked so well? You're supposed to be managing a fishery. And one thing you can manage strictly is regulation. If it's working so well, the management restrictions, why are we in these dire straits?
Well, I do want to go to Tom, but Brendan, if you want to respond to Jerry, then I have a question for Tom.
Yes, and just to address the comment that we are, since 2008, we have not been doing as much as we did that year. We are working under the same management structure that was established in 2008 right now. And last year when we had the large decline in abundance, we reduced harvest an additional 10%. So those restrictions are still in place that we put in place last year. We are discussing an additional 10% reduction this year on top of what we did last year. The piece that we can control with this management structure and these regulations is the amount of female harvest, and we have been successful at keeping that in what is considered by CVSAC to be the safe zone. There is large fluctuations naturally occurring in the population. We have been at levels with lower abundance of small crabs in the bay. In fact, in 2009, we had less small crabs in the bay than we have right now, to come back in 2010 to have the largest abundance of female spawning stock that we've seen in the history of the Winter Dredge Survey. So all of this variability comes into play, and the harvest, as long as it is maintained in that safe zone, leaves enough crabs for there to be potential to have improved abundance.
Well, I'll let you come back and respond, but I do want to ask Tom Parham a question here. I mean, I mean, about the realities of the Bay and what the situation we're actually dealing with. I mean, because and whether it's crabs that are now like $85 a dozen, so that's an insane number for male crabs that people want to buy. So, I mean, what is the situation we're dealing with in terms of water quality? I mean, some people would argue that it is fairly disastrous.
Well, I mean, that's what we do here. But let me just back up for a second. Right now, we've been working with all the different Bay states and with you know, the Bay program, which we're a part of, to restore the Bay. And there's been words bounced around. People probably heard TMDL and all sorts of things. Basically, it boils down to this: we want to have more oxygen for fish, crabs, and shellfish. We want to have clear water for underwater grasses. So, in order to reach those goals, we've set these action plans, and we know by a certain point, every 2 years, we look back and say, are we reaching our, you know, our restoration actions? So we're on track in order by 2025 to have everything in place. And so where we are right now is we are on track to reduce polluted runoff to provide a cleaner and clearer waterways. So we are actually, we are not seeing a lot in the main bay itself. We're actually seeing improvements in some of the non-tidal and the tidal fresh areas, or the lower salinity areas of the bay. So we know in certain areas, like in the Potomac River, through upgrades in wastewater treatment plants, through a lot of these actions throughout the bay, we are seeing clear water. We're seeing reduced lower amounts of algae in the water, clear water, and more underwater grasses. However, it hasn't made its way all the way to the bay. To the main parts of the bay that folks traditionally think of the bay, the main stem of the bay. However, we're on schedule, and if we continue our actions, we should be reaching these, you know, our goals set for enough oxygen for fish, crabs, and shellfish, and clear water for underwater grasses. So, right now, like I said, you're going to see improvements in the tidal fresh areas, but it hasn't made its way all the way down to the main parts of the bay.
Jerry?
Well, the Chesapeake Bay in Maryland and Virginia remains severely degraded. That's according to the EPA. Most of the waters in the bay and in the tributaries do not meet Clean Water Act requirements that were set 30 years ago. We're in violation of the Clean Water Act. We set a goal that our governors signed back in 2000 to restore bay grasses, which are essential for crab populations, to 185,000 acres. Well, we were supposed to meet that in 2010, gave ourselves a decade, and we're actually at 32% of the goal. In fact, in 2012, we hit lows not seen since 1986 and had a slight uptick in 2013 in bay grasses. There are 40 times more juvenile crabs in bay grasses than in barren bottom. We've destroyed 75-80% of the viable oyster bars in the bay because of excess sediment and other environmental pollution. And that is mainly 59% of those sediment comes from agriculture, which we failed to address. The oyster population, even though the governor, in a DNR press release, took credit for the great management actions in Maryland, given the weather, when you see a crab crash, when you see a rockfish starting to decline, it's never management. It's always the weather. It's some environmental factor. It's even red drum eating the crabs now. And so you don't see the governor at those conferences or those releases. But when we heard about the oyster going up in Maryland, the population slightly, still at probably 1% of historical numbers, you see this not attributable to any natural fluctuations or good weather conditions that allowed for the crabs, to the oysters, to reproduce and for survival. So what I'm coming at is we're not doing enough to restore the bay, and we're not doing enough to manage the fisheries, or else you wouldn't see a collapsed shad fishery. That's almost never mentioned. The shad was the biggest fishery fish that in commercially fished in the Chesapeake Bay region back in 1900. Maryland had to impose, because of the lack of management up until then and the overfishing and the environmental pollution, a total moratorium on all shad harvest in the Chesapeake Bay, Maryland's portion, in 1980 by regulation. So that's 34 years ago. That fishery is still collapsed. And the Conowingo Dam, the measurements there, were supposed to, the goal in the Bay program, which the gentleman just spoke, Mr. Parham, about the goals, we set a goal. Our governors agreed to have 2 million fish coming up the Conowingo at the face of the dam with the $12 million fish lift there to get them higher up the spawn. We're achieving somewhere in the 20,000 shad, not 2 million, 20,000. It's a total failure. The fishery is still closed because we let over-harvest occur along with the pollution. People talk about soft clam. The soft clam fishery has collapsed. There's almost no harvest data in Maryland because of pollution in the bay and over-harvest. We've had a fishery for centuries. It's even mentioned in the charter for King Charles I. For sturgeon, and that fishery is totally collapsed. Both of the species are declared endangered species. And now we're facing a decline in the signature species of the bay, the blue crab, and we're hearing where we can't manage, we're already managing. My last point quickly is that the mention by the young lady from DNR about us
Brenda
doing
Davis.
What's the management plan, the actual threshold for female targets, this is the critical driving element, is 215 million crabs. That's the target. We are way below that. It's only at 69 million. We were supposed to be at 215 million. We haven't reached that for the last 4 years. And secondly, the threshold, which says we're overfished, is 70 million female crabs, and we're at 69. We need to put harvest restrictions in now and not allow Waterman to take up to 30 bushels of female crabs a day.
So let's go. Tom and Brenda, I'd like you to respond. Please, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. Brenda first, or I can go first.
Go ahead, Tom.
All right. Thank you, Senator. Let me address just the water quality comments that you made. When we, working with the Bay Program and all the Bay states, we knew that if we reduce a certain amount of nitrogen and phosphorus and sediment, we can achieve our dissolved oxygen and our water clarity goals for a restored bay. So we have a plan put in place and 2-year milestones, and we're achieving each of those 2-year milestones as far as restoration actions. We have, while we do, when you look at the whole bay, we are failing the, what you were mentioning before, all the criteria right now. When you look at the water quality trends, what our group does, is we go out and collect water samples throughout the bay, monthly or even more frequently. We've been doing this in 1985. And so what this allows us to do is to see how things are getting better or things are getting worse, and it kind of takes out the noise from having a dry year or a wet year or what you're mentioning, Senator, about weather impacts. But we know that even though we are not achieving our water quality goals yet, we know that the water quality trends are showing things are getting better. So while we haven't met it yet, things are getting better in some of these areas, the areas that I was mentioning. So we have a plan, and if we achieve the plan, we should meet our goals. We are taking steps, and through our 2-year milestones, we are achieving those goals. And as I mentioned before, we have these 2-year milestones. They work through 2025. By 2025, we'll have all the actions in place where we should see a restored bay at some point after that. So we're starting to see responses in our trend work. So while I certainly hear you that we're not seeing right now that the water conditions in the bay aren't at our goal levels, they are showing improvements in some of these areas.
So let me let Brenda come back in.
Sure.
Brenda?
Yes. And it is correct that 215 million spawning age females is the target, and we are holding to the management strategy that we think will get us to that target, and that is limiting harvest of females to somewhere around 25.5% of the baywide stock. So, and just to sort of look back, in previous years, when we had abundances of females that were below that 70 million threshold, we had harvest rates that were well above the 35% harvest threshold. So we are in a completely different place with this low abundance than where we have been in the past as far as being able to regulate that harvest. According to the work done by many Bay Area scientists, the harvest management structure that we have right now leaves sufficient spawning stock, given favorable conditions, to be able to increase abundance.
So we only have a few minutes left in this segment. So literally like 3 or 4 minutes left in this segment. I'd like you all to kind of close out here. And I just wonder where we go from here, because one of the things that I would just say very quickly, having covered this intensely for the last 21 years, and before that being involved in it as well, that we keep having these goals that keep being pushed off because we can't seem to make them, whether it's putting off the PMT, the phosphorus management tool, one more year, maybe 2 more years, whatever that is. We're having a difficult time really seeming to put our hands around the kind of meeting the goal to save the Bay in a reasonable time. People can argue whether it's too late or not, or where we are. So just closing comments on that, and I mean very quickly, because we do have to wind up here in 4 minutes, literally. Jerry?
Well, it's a real tragedy of the commons what has occurred here in the Chesapeake Bay. I've lived here all my life close to the water. I'm looking out on the bay as I speak, and my thing in retirement is to catch a few crabs, have 2 pots, adhere to all the laws strictly, and have the cull rings on my pots. And it's really pathetic when I see what's happened in the bay, people getting infections in their leg, threatening their lives because of the lack of stormwater control and agricultural controls. So Mr. Parham is correct. In some river systems, only those where we've controlled the biggest source of pollution, some of those river systems, which is from sewage, are we making progress. In other areas dominated by agriculture or urban stormwater runoff, we do not see progress. In fact, we see things staying the way as bad as they always were, or even worse.
Jerry, we only have like a minute left. We have to let Tom and Brenna have
We failed to address agriculture and stormwater. And finally, there is not a consensus by Bay scientists. One of the best independent scientists, not tied to a federal or state agency, is Tuck Hines, Dr. Hines, at the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center. And he has publicly and continually says he's an expert on blue crabs. We need to restrict female harvest and do it now.
Tom Parham, very quickly. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
All right. We have, like I said, we have the steps in action in order to hit a restored bay. The difference about this bay agreement and the previous ones is the other ones were voluntary. This one is not voluntary. We will start to continue to see improving trends throughout the bay. And the whole goal is to provide more oxygen so you have more habitat for the bay's fish, crabs, and shellfish. We are on schedule, and it's going to take some time, and simply because there's excess nutrients in the bay, there'll be a bit of the lag times. However, if our plan is sound, our actions are on track in order to meet the restored bay.
I want to thank you. I apologize, Brenda, because we have literally 30 seconds left, and I've got to get to the next segment, which is taped for people to hear what happened the other night. But I want to thank Brenda Davis, our natural resource biologist at the DNR, and Tom Parham, environmental specialist with the Department of Natural Resources, joining Jerry Weingrad, former state senator and Bay advocate. Thank the three of you so much for taking your time with our listeners here on Sound Bites and the Mark Steiner Show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
On our way to our next segment here, taped from what we did the other night on Food and Faith, reminding you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the most important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's one word, MarylandEducators.org. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites right here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and Delmarva Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM, and WSCL 89.5 FM. And we're listening to a panel that I moderated last week at the Pleasant Hope Baptist Church in Baltimore. The panel was part of a series called Good Food Gatherings. It was called Teaching Well, How Can We Educate Our Youth, Adults, and Communities About Good Food? It was about the intersection of food and faith. First of all, I want to introduce at the very end, because his church is hosting us, the Reverend Dr. Heber M. Brown III is our host this evening. And I say it that way because I've known Heber Brown for a while now. He's been a guest on my show many times. Reverend Brown just got his Doctor of Ministry degree from Wesley Theological Seminary. And he has just been one of the leading activists in our community around homelessness, poverty, racism, white privilege. The prison industrial complex worked very hard with our young people to oppose the building of the youth jail in this community, workers' rights, environmental justice, global justice. And his thesis really was built around this work he's doing called Oritza's Cross, which is an African-centered church school curriculum that for our young people in churches that blends African spirituality and the African interpretive matrix. And it's a whole theory he's developed about how young African-American children can be educated and taught. He's been named many things by many people. Urbanite magazine called him one of the change makers of Baltimore City. And he's offered a sanctuary for us to speak here today. We're also joined, next to him, is Dr. Jeanette Hablula, who is a doctor of naturopathy, a divinely guided healer. She's been worked as a holistic healer since 1992, and she's been studying the Quran for 25 years and has traveled extensively, teaching and lecturing around the Quran. She runs retreats combining Quranic knowledge with her understanding of holistic principles. She's written two books, The Magnificent Organ and Orientation to Holistic Thought, lives here in Maryland, has five children, seven grandchildren, one great-grandchild, and lives with us here in the state of Maryland. Ari Witkin is an organizer, educator, and facilitator who's passionate about our community and putting faith into action. He's currently working with a number of nonprofits, including the Greater Homewood Community Corporation. He's worked as coordinator of apprenticeship and multicultural programming at the Pearlstone Center. And he served as the lead staff for both the Greater Homewood Interfaith Alliance and the Baltimore Interfaith Coalition, graduated from Goucher College, and this fall will be beginning his rabbinical studies at the Reconstruction Rabbinical College in Philadelphia. So, very exciting. We're going to start with Ari Witkin, just work our way down the panel. Ari?
I'm going to speak a little bit about the Jewish community, the way we engage in food education and agricultural education, my experience doing so, and maybe contextualize it a little bit with our tradition. First thing I want to say about it from a Jewish perspective is that I feel really lucky to be a part of a spiritual tradition that's really embraced this food movement. Nationally, there's a growing contingent of Jewish individuals, organizations, and congregations that are really taking on food and agriculture issues as a central question and program within what they're doing on a day-to-day basis. And that's really laid out in a beautiful way that's actually been pretty effective at evangelism at the same time, sort of in a funny way. This Jewish food movement has really fired up people's spirituality in general. It's been a touch point for a lot of individuals, and I think that's worth noting when we talk about education, because everybody eats, right? Everybody eats, everybody has to eat, and you can escape going to church or to synagogue, you can escape reading books or going to school, but you can't really escape eating, and it can be a beautiful and powerful entry point to your relationship with God and the earth as a result of putting food in the context of faith. So I want to applaud the Jewish community as a whole at picking that up. And Rabbi Nina Beth Cardin's looking at me right now, and she's really one of our champions of that. So I want to name that since she's here. So that's how I wound up in this movement. And for me, that's actually my story. I worked for a few years, as Mark said, at the Pearlstone Center in Reisterstown, Some people might have heard of Kayam Farm at the Pearlstone Center. It's an educational farm that's really doing this work exactly. They're welcoming about 5,000 people a year, mostly kids, but people of all ages, into educational programs around food and farming. And they're doing that in a few different ways. One, with people coming for long-term stays, and also with Sunday schools coming and going out into the community and helping congregations build gardens and do a variety of things. So that's my background professionally and personally, and I wound up there not because I was interested in food, but because I was thirsty for spirituality, and these people were bringing it to life. And I was like, whoa, food and Judaism are explosive. And when we talk about education, I think really the most important part from a Jewish perspective is to recognize that Jewish tradition is based around agriculture. You know, Judaism is often, we're often called the people of the book because we have an immense canon of literature about who we are and what we do and how we practice. And more than 20% of that literature in the rabbinic period, so we're talking about the formative Jewish law, is about agriculture. It's about food production. It's about how we eat. It's about what we eat. It's about how we plant. It's about who eats and how we make sure that everyone eats. The other thing I want to say is that I think the beginning of any story is really important. And the beginning of our story from a biblical perspective, and a story I share with Christian tradition and partially with the Islamic tradition as well, it is about being a steward of the earth. And that's about how we grow food. It's about how we make sure that our planet continues. And that educating Jewish kids, educating any kids, has to be based in that, because it's the first part of our story, and it's what helps our story continue.
Good evening. Assalamu alaikum, peace be with everyone. So I just want to share, like, the way that I work. I moved around quite a bit. I'm not sort of grounded in any one particular group, so I'm not here representing a particular group, but just the Islamic community in general. The Ummah, we call it the Ummah, the whole greater community. And I move around, and a lot of what I do is educational. So, but I see this whole thing of moving individuals or groups into a more just food production, consumption, and the sustainability of everything. It's like in five levels, and there's fluidity amongst these levels. And so the first one is engaging the people. You have to engage them. And in order to engage people, you have to speak to them on the level of their interest. Otherwise, they're not going to listen to you, whether they're in your church or masjid or whatever. So you have to engage them at the point of their interest. Or what is meaningful to them. So you have to engage people on a meaningful level. Secondly is the education, which I mentioned. And this is something that I think you have to look at all means of educating people. So I have moved around and done all of it, and I see people using different techniques. Having talks like such as this one, where you're doing education and discussion, allowing people to ask. I have, been involved in offering retreats and seminars focusing on specific topics. One of the very early ones we did back in 2006 at University of Missouri was called Islam and Holistic Healing. And you can't really talk about the healing without talking about food. I'm a healer. I work in healing. But you can't do it without talking about the diet, the consumption, the types of foods, the quality of food, what's going into the body. So that's something. And here lately, I have been really focusing on how the food affects our ability to worship. First of all, just the worship in general, that if you're not eating properly, you may be out of compliance with your own religion because of the laws that are mentioned in the Torah, in the Bible, in our Quran. There are laws related to food. And if you're not eating properly, you may be out of compliance. You may be in disobedience to the Lord that you want to follow. So that's very important that you, when you're educating, you connect your guidance to sacred text. You base it in the sacred text. For instance, the primary ayah or verse in our Quran related to food is addressed to all humanity. Ya ayyuhannas, O humanity, O you human beings, eat from what is on the earth permissible. First of all, what God has permitted for you to eat. Secondly, it's a quality called tayyib, which is the wholesome, beneficial, good quality of the food. And so we have to, I don't talk to my people in general about halal. You've heard that term halal, which you're going to see more and more all over now. You're seeing it in the stores. You're seeing it, you know, producers, everybody, you know, wants to get in on this as the Muslim population increases and we get more conscious about our food. Everybody wants to kind of get in on that halal label as they did with the kosher label. So you're seeing that now. So I don't need to talk about them in general, but I need to get into the specifics of what is permissible, which is the tayyib. Because in one place, that's the primary verse is in the second chapter, but in the fifth chapter, it says, "Uhilla lakum at-tayyibat, I have made permissible for you all good, beneficial, wholesome things." So you have to we have to understand, as Muslims, what is this tayyib? How do we make sure that we're consuming what is tayyib? Because that's the only thing that's lawful. So that comes in what we're talking about, food that is just, food that is trustworthy, food that is kind to the environment, kind to the people, kind to the creatures. All of that comes into and so that's what I focus my education on here lately, and I've been doing some of those at the MCC in Silver Springs. So the education is very important, and you have to be very patient in educating your people. This is one thing you may not see the results of it for a long time. These are seeds, right? And sometimes it takes a seed a long time to grow. So there are and you have to be, you know, look at all the aspects, all the ways. We've done, as you mentioned, the two books, but also have CDs. Some of them are on Amazon. You know, you try to get things out there. You try to get information out there. We did 7 years of a holistic health newsletter, so I was starting to feel like I was talking to myself, you know. But anyway, and so then the partnering. And, you know, we are, because we don't have in our faith group so many things. We don't have raw milk dairy farms or organic farms. So we're partnering with other people. You find the Muslim communities partnering with the Amish, partnering with the Mennonites. We joined the Wild for Salmon fisheries to get the wild caught fish. We're partnering with people. And so that's very important. And when we partner, we're looking to partner with people of faith, you know, because we want food that is grown with a faith-based consciousness, as I already mentioned about the stewardship. We want people conscious of that. And the last thing is bequeathing what you mentioned about teaching the children. You've got to teach the children. You've got to get them involved. Otherwise, all of your work is going to be lost, right? So we are getting the children involved in the farming, and also in understanding, visiting these farms, understanding the importance of the earth and our connection to the earth, because it's integral. We are one. This is a principle of basic principle of Islam is Tawheed, oneness. And I'll end there.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me and for us sharing this space together. Let me start by just telling you a little story. When I first came here it's been 6 years now. And when I first came to Pleasant Hope Baptist Church, I encountered many things that I never imagined that I would as a pastor. I'm a third-generation Baptist preacher, and I guess I had some naivete and arrogance about, I know how this thing goes. It's in my blood. It's the family business, right? But shortly after sitting in the big chair and being the one everybody's looking to, I learned some things that I did not know. One of the things that was important that I picked up was the amount of energy and the amount of focus and the importance attached to giving care and support to people while they're in sickness and going through various health challenges. And so I started pastoring at 28 years old. And at 28 years old, I was in more hospitals than I'd ever been in my entire life. Father Joe and others who are here in ministry, sensitive to just the amount of reaching out to people being in the hospital. It was to the point where the people at the front desk for all of the local hospitals knew me by name because I was coming to visit various members. Well, the number of those visits picked up to such a degree that I said to myself, you know what, something's got to change around here. Because I recognized that for a number of the persons I was coming to give just support and trying to do the best I could in terms of giving some encouragement to, the challenges that brought them to the hospital were, in some regard, diet-related issues. And so I wanted to dream about ways that we could do something to minister to people in an unconventional way. And that's how the garden came to be. In 2010, we started the garden. We started growing food right here at Pleasant Hope just as a way to demonstrate a different way of being, a way to kind of spark the imagination of people again, which wasn't difficult here at Pleasant Hope. This is a historically African-American congregation. And for many of the people that I'm blessed to share life with here, they are folks who grew up, as we say, down the country, on the farms, with families. And so many of the elders of this community, I wasn't saying anything new when I started talking about growing our food. It wasn't nothing new. And so we've been blessed to, since 2010, have a garden here, to be growing food, to be having forums like this about good food and sustainability. And for so many who are under the sound of my voice, you've been remarkable partners in helping us to be on top of this here at Pleasant Hope. One of the things that I've learned in this, and Mark mentioned my project and my research deals with, I've titled it Orita's Cross, which is an African-centered church school curriculum. Really what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to transform Sunday schools into freedom schools. I want every church to have a freedom school. And so Sunday school becomes training ground for the next wave of change makers. Dr. King and Rosa Parks and so many people that we lift up, the seeds for their revolutionary spirit was planted in Sunday school. Dr. King was a troublemaker in Sunday school. He would raise questions that his Sunday school teacher could not answer. Rosa Parks down in the Deep South, as people were getting lynched in her community, it was her Sunday school teacher that helped to give her some oomph and some fire to say, yes, you are a black girl in the Deep South and Jim Crow and discrimination. Oh, my bell's going off. But it was her Sunday school teacher that helped do that. So I'm not the only thing I'm striving to do is to reintroduce the spirit of the civil rights era freedom schools back into our black churches in particular. And one of the things that's important for that is that in the freedom school construction, this whole teacher-student hierarchy is challenged. We all are students. And so even for this movement, we all are students. We're here to learn from one another. We're here to hear different perspectives and views. And so one of the things that I had to learn, even as I engaged more with this movement and many of the things that many of you are doing, I had to make sure that I came off my high horse and made sure I came down at eye level with people and took time, as my sister said and others have said, to listen before I spoke and to understand that I'm not bringing some precious knowledge down from the sweets of, you know, progressivism to people. For many people, they already know this stuff. I grew up on 1921 West Edmondson Avenue. As a little boy in the early 80s growing up, and some of y'all just said, I got shoes older than him. I know. But in on 1921 West Edmondson Avenue, particularly on Saturday mornings, we'd be watching He-Man and our Saturday morning cartoons, and the window would be cracked just a little bit after we just finished scrubbing those marble steps on Edmondson Avenue. And through the window, I would hear, get your watermelon, strawberries. My brother and I would run outside. And we see the Arabs going down the street. And we didn't care about the fruit. We just looked at the horses. The horses going up and down the street. And what that jogged my memory was that a lot of this, particularly in the black community, we've been there, done that. You know, let's be honest. Sometimes we come off as if this is some precious knowledge that we're bringing to people who don't know anything about it. If we plug into people's stories, we might find out that folks been here for a long time. And like those bell bottoms you got in your closet, it's just coming back around again. It's just a new emphasis or a renewed emphasis to something that's already been here for a long time. And so I'm thankful for the ways in which we are learning from one another, that we're making space to hear each other's stories and learning what needs to be done today to help keep the good food movement and all these other important issues going forward. So thank you so much.
Here we are in a world that is dominated by the giant industrial agricultural machine. Here we are in a world that all the food that we like but don't want to eat, shouldn't eat, don't want our kids to eat, is in our face every day, all the time. And we have places in our communities where all that we don't want is deeply accessible. But decent food is not deeply accessible. And I thought about your A-Rabber thing. I'll come back to A-Rabbers a little bit later in the conversation and the role they might play in our future and how that might happen. But so I'm curious how you take the power of faith communities to transform that in this world we live in. You know, you have this plot of land over here, Heber Brown, where you're doing this garden, and there are empty spaces across the city. that just lay fallow. And so I'm curious what you think, you all think, that communities of faith, the role they play and how they create a different model, a different way of doing things, a way that doesn't say, the Mexicans in many places right now have just banned Monsanto. They don't want them in their fields. So what is it we do here in Baltimore, Maryland, in communities of faith? Where does it begin?
I think one of the places it begins is right here in the sanctuary, in all of our sanctuaries. I think the sanctuary is that sacred and safe place for us to have not only conversations, but also to dream wild dreams. And I think if we're going to really get some traction with so many of these important issues, we need space to dream wild dreams. And I'm saying intentionally, wild dreams. We're not going up against some simple amateur position when it comes to good food. This is an industrial complex. These are pros at this. When you walk into the grocery store, you're already under attack and don't even know it by that sweet sounding music and the smells in the room and all the science that goes into us staying on the conveyor belt of the industrial complex of the big agribusinesses. And so when we understand how sophisticated the opposition is, we don't really have margin to have safe conversations anymore about how to transform our communities and create the systems that we need. Where do we have wild conversations? I think it's in the sanctuaries, because we have in our sacred text, in the richness of our faith, we have this sustainable fuel that would help jumpstart, recharge, and give push and motivation to many of the planning that needs to happen. How many of the world's revolutions started in the basements of the mosque and the churches and the temples and the synagogues of the local people? Because oftentimes this was the only space we could control, that we could create a venue for to have the planning time and the structure that we needed. And so let's have wild conversations again. Let's dream and imagine in the sanctuaries. And I think that's one step of many that we need to take to help capitalize on what we need to do to move forward.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think one of the things Heber reminds me of is one time I had a group of kids come to the farm out in Reisterstown from the city, and we take the kids on a variety of activities. We do some team building stuff, and then we were in the field and we were picking strawberries. And I had a student, and he said, "I didn't know a strawberry grew on a bush." I said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, why don't you taste that strawberry?" And he tasted it, and he was like, "This isn't what a strawberry tastes like." Because along with this corporate takeover that he was talking about, we're also being fed not real food. And to see this kid light up like that brings me to a point that Dr. Hobula made about meeting people where they're at. Some people need to taste a strawberry for the first time. Some people need to be told that they can convert the way that their congregation buys energy. Not the kid who's tasting the strawberry for the first time isn't ready to talk about hydroelectric. That's not the conversation he wants to be having right now. But he does want another strawberry, right? And when he comes to church or when he comes to synagogue, he'll be excited to choose a strawberry instead of a sugar cookie, right? So I also think it's about congregations making a decision to invest their resources in different ways. So that can look like a lot of different things. And I want to be clear that every step counts. And if you are a member of a congregation or lead a congregation, I'm not asking you to totally convert the way your institution operates today. I'm asking you to not buy styrofoam plates anymore, or to start serving fruit instead of cookies. Or maybe you're already doing those things and you want to talk about, where do we invest our congregation's endowment? Do we invest in companies that are pouring chemicals into the food that our children are eating? So giving people the opportunity to have that first strawberry moment can look really different for different people, but that's the most important way to start, I think.
I agree with both of those, and I would say that, because people, when I go around, and people say to me, well, how do we do this? What do we do? So you have to give people attainable steps, and what you were saying, and you're like, okay, a strawberry. But you have to give them okay, you can't maybe change everything all at once. And people say, well, I can't buy all the organic stuff. It's too expensive. So you have to help them to see how they can do it within their budget, within their abilities, within their capability, and help them to see the value of it. See, the thing is, like, if you eat well, you can eat less because your body is being nourished and sustained and you don't have hunger. Your hunger, a lot of times, people's hunger is because the body has not been nourished and it's still wanting nourishment, so that's translating as hunger. Their hunger is, though, for real food. So you have to help people to take those small steps and then let them see the differences. And they come and share those stories. As I had a woman in, we've been doing a series of talks at the MCC, the Muslim Community Center in Silver Spring, Maryland. And she said, I can't buy the regular vegetables out of the grocery store because my kids get sick. Now, maybe everybody's children are not getting sick like her children are, so she has to buy the more better quality, the organic. She has to go to, like, the smaller health food stores or whatever, or the farmers markets and get the real food. But then they begin to understand, well, if her children are getting sick, maybe mine are not doing so well either. Maybe that ADD, ADHD, and, you know, other things, maybe my children are having problems, the diabetes and et cetera, et cetera. So you help them to take the small steps, share the successes, which will encourage others. And, you know, because success brings happiness, brings hope. And, you know, maybe somebody who's been told, oh, your child's going to have to take this medicine forever, and then you change the diet and things change. So give them the small steps. And once we start making those small steps, we can move to the bigger things. And again, the partnering. If we don't join together, I really don't truly see the communal or, you know, in a city or in this nation, I don't see the true success. We have to stop seeing our divisions and see where we blend, where we can integrate and join together.
This was the first part of the panel I moderated last week at the Pleasant Hope Baptist Church in Baltimore. It was part of a series called Good Food Gatherings and was called Teaching Well. How can we educate our youth, adults, and communities about good food? It was about the intersection of food and faith. And our guests were the Reverend Dr. Heber Brown, pastor of the Pleasant Hope Baptist Church and a key community leader, organizer, educator, and facilitator Ari Witkin, and healer and doctor of naturopathy, Dr. Jeanette Hablula. Our partners for this event were the Center for Livable Futures Food and Faith Project and Interfaith Power and Light. Next week, we'll hear the second part of this conversation. The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are a production of the Center for Emerging Media, made possible in part by a grant from the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer at WEAA is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Public Radio Delmarva is Christopher Rank. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and find out information from the interviews we are doing on this program, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcasts on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and for WSDL 90.7 FM and WSDL 89.5 FM, Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.